This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, spoke of nightmarish scenes on the Mediterranean on Saturday. There were several operations, desperate attempts to save lives, and Doctors Without Borders rescued around 99 migrants from a rubber boat that was sinking in the Mediterranean.
That's Josephine McKenna reporting from Rome. Full details coming up. Also, today is the final day of a two-day summit in Addis Ababa, where leaders from the African Union countries and regions are meeting. An Egyptian politician, Musa Mustafa Musa, said today he would compete in presidential elections hours before a nomination deadline was set to make President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi the sole candidate. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story. Today is the final day of a two-day summit in Addis Ababa where leaders from the African Union countries and regions are meeting to discuss and make decisions on the reform of the AU, Africa integration, and especially addressing corruption and how to stop it. Hailing the partnership between Africa and the United Nations as solid and grounded on sound principles of human rights and good governance, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the leaders gathering at the summit that with Africa in the lead, we can and will do more to bolster successful cooperation throughout the continent. One major accomplishment at the summit was the launch of a single African air transport market at the opening ceremony. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who assumed as this year's AU chairperson, announced the launch of the market. Kagame said the launch of the air transport market will gain almost 300,000 direct jobs and millions of indirect jobs. Of the 55 members of the AU, 23 countries have signed relevant documents to construct the market. In Somalia, low rainfall for a fifth consecutive growing season has aid agencies sounding the alert. More than a third of the population is in need of food assistance, and that number could grow in coming months. Mohamed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
Below average rainfall in Somalia has aid agencies concerned about this year's harvest, expected to begin in April. But aid officials say the situation has not reached the level it did at the same time last year, when the United Nations warned of a potential famine. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia, Peter de Klerk, updated reporters Monday in Mogadishu.
I'm very pleased to report and to announce that the risk of famine has declined through our collective action. We can be very proud of this achievement, but we cannot be complacent. This is not a mission accomplished moment. The humanitarian situation remains critical, and these gains are fragile and could easily be reversed without sustained assistance. The impact of drought and conflict continues to cause suffering and drive people from their homes.
Food production is expected to be below normal again this year in most of Somalia, according to a recent survey by Somalia's Food Security and Analysis Unit, a project managed by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Without continued large-scale assistance, the agency says food security is expected to deteriorate in the next 5 months. Sergio Innocente works with the Food and Agriculture Organization.
Close to half of the population of Somalia that is anywhere in between stress into emergency conditions. So we have over 4.4 million people in need of support, out of which half, close to 3 million people, are close to a humanitarian disaster.
The survey shows 300,000 children are in need of food aid, including 48,000 who are severely malnourished. Innocente says the report is a call to action.
We have seen that the response of last year has been timely and has been up to scale, so which proves that in reality Even though we are not calling this early warning, we are absolutely convinced that a continuous update helps people in taking informed decision, and this is what we want for Somalia.
On Tuesday, the Somali government is expected to launch its humanitarian response and action plan for 2018. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Rescue services in Italy report two women died and many others are presumed drowned after a migrant boat carrying dozens of people sank in the Mediterranean on Saturday. Among the people rescued were three babies who were revived by medical teams. The rescue charity SOS Mediterranean said on Twitter, "A tragic day in the Mediterranean. People were already in the water. 83 people saved and safely on board. Two women could not be revived, leaving two children orphaned." Doctors Without Borders, who also helped in the rescue operation, said, "Many people are missing and presumed drowned, including children." Italian Coast Guard on Saturday said, "A total of 800 people were rescued in five separate operations." My colleague, Kim Lewis, spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna about the rescue operations.
Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, spoke of nightmarish scenes on the Mediterranean on Saturday. There were several operations, desperate attempts to save lives, and Doctors Without Borders rescued around 99 migrants from a rubber boat that was sinking in the Mediterranean. But an unknown number of men, women and children are missing, presumed drowned. Now, two mothers were confirmed dead. Three babies were rescued and revived by medical teams, but the staff were saying the scene was absolutely devastating, with many urgent medical cases in quick succession, just one after the other. Migrants who are unconscious, not breathing, young children with water on their lungs had to be taken by helicopter to the nearest hospital in Tunisia. And really a very tragic scene, even though the Italian Coast Guard said that it was able to rescue around 800 people in several different operations on Saturday.
Were these people coming from sub-Saharan Africa?
We understand that most of them were traveling from Libya, but we haven't had very much information about that. As I said, the medical emergencies, around 16 people in total, were taken to Tunisia. But the Aquarius, the boat of Doctors Without Borders, was sent to the scene of this major rescue, which took place somewhere in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya.
And I know we had talked about the numbers previously, that they were down in terms of people trying to cross the Mediterranean, but still they continue to try to cross.
That's right. We've seen more than 3,000, close to 3,200 migrants this year traveling from Libya to the Italian coast. And of course, it's always heartbreaking when any of the rescue teams find that they can't save lives. And this was one of those occasions at the weekend. So we're still seeing migrants arrive, even though the numbers last year were well down on 2016. And it's still a very big issue in Italy, of course, leading up to the national elections that are going to take place here in early March.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis in Rome. Since late last year, Ugandan medical facilities have been grappling with a severe blood shortage. The crisis underscores a longer-term struggle to get Ugandans to give blood. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
National referral hospitals across Uganda are stuck with patients who badly need blood transfusions. These include pregnant mothers, accident victims, patients who need surgery, and those with sickle cell anemia, among others. The blood shortage has taken a huge toll on the acute children's wards, casualties, and operating rooms in different hospitals. Stephen Obo is the director of Mbale Regional Referral Hospital in eastern Uganda. He confirms that his hospital is one of those affected by the ongoing shortage.
We have run short of blood in the institution, and we are working together with the blood bank to ensure that we receive the supply. They have promised to send us more blood.
Yes, there are promises of supplying the needed blood, but the National Blood Bank in Kampala has run out of stocks. A visit to the bank shows many coolers with blood requests from different hospitals are lying empty. Although 1,000 units are needed by hospitals daily, the National Blood Bank currently has only 150 units in its cold room. Dr. Dorothy Cheyune is the Executive Director, Uganda Blood Transfusion Services, or UTBS. She says the blood collection drive has been greatly affected by the winding up of the funding by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, in 2016.
Our activities are transport-related. Every day, teams go out in the communities, in the field, to collect blood. They need fuel, they need sound vehicles, we need allowances for staff, which money was being supported by the PEPFAR project, which ended. So we are struggling. We can't mobilize, we can't go out to collect. We had planned to do more blood collection sessions, we are doing less. So when you go out less, you collect less.
On a daily basis, 20 mobile teams are sent out to collect blood with a minimum target of 50 units each. UTBS needs about $4.5 million for the blood collection drives annually, but only $2.6 million has been allocated in this financial year's budget. The Health Ministry has asked the government for extra money to fund blood transfusion initiatives. Sarah Pendi is Uganda's Minister of State for Health.
I've already got in touch with the Minister of Finance, and we hope that something is going to be done very soon, maybe in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
The UTBS is appealing to Ugandans to wholly embrace blood donations. Michael Mkundane is the spokesperson, UTBS.
We don't coerce people. This is a voluntary activity. We must have the humanitarian heart, the availability of safe, adequate blood for our patients with severe anemia in hospitals depends on the generosity of all those that donate the blood. Should there not be generosity in terms of feeling for humanity to share the blood, those with, who are feeling well and with excess and can share with our patients, then we shall have a shortage.
Uganda does not import blood and only depends on blood donors within the country. However, some people fear to donate blood, saying it is infected with diseases like HIV and hepatitis, even without proof that it really is. Annually, Uganda needs over 340,000 units of blood, but last year, only 240,000 units were collected, leaving a shortage of about 100,000 units. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Zambian hip-hop artist Fumba Chama has never shied away from provocative lyrics, but his most recent hit has forced him to flee into exile amid threats on his life from those who see the song as criticism of President Edgar Lungu. VOA's Anita Powell spoke with the exiled musician and has this report.
Fumba Chama, better known by his stage name Pilato, spoke with VOA from an undisclosed location. He went into hiding after releasing the catchy dance track Kozwe Mupoto, or Rat in the Pot, in the Bemba language, in December.
I started getting threats, both as voice notes and video clips, of warnings telling me what they were going to do to me. They told me they were going to beat me. Some were saying I deserve to die. I was going to be killed. Some were saying even if I was going to the courts, I was going to be snatched away from the courts and be dealt with.
Pilato took these threats seriously and left Zambia earlier this month. Rights groups have documented tightening restrictions under President Edgar Lungu, saying there has been growing political intolerance and politically motivated arrests. The 33-year-old Pilato is no stranger to controversy and spares no one with his sharp words. In 2011, he released a song in which he called some members of the Zambian parliament mental patients. That was followed in 2013 with a single in which he called then-President Michael Sata the father of lies. In 2015, Pilato says he was arrested for defaming the president and disturbing the peace for a song in which he called Lungu a drunk. Pilato says the case was thrown out of court. In his newest song, Pilato raps about leaders who behave like rats, stealing food and other things they do not need. The lyrics drew immediate condemnation from the ruling Patriotic Front's Youth League, which released a statement giving him 48 hours to withdraw the track. VOA calls to Zambian officials went unanswered, but the nation's High Commissioner to South Africa has vigorously denied that any threats came from the government. Rights group Amnesty International has called on Zambia's government to stop cracking down on dissent. Amnesty researcher Lloyd Kuveya says the group believes important freedoms are at risk.
We are really concerned about the issue of freedom of expression and assembly and association. So the moment a government starts to crack down on one individual, it's not going to stop. And we've seen that sort of thing happening in countries like Zimbabwe, for instance.
Pilato says whatever happens, he will not stop singing.
I keep making these songs because they are necessary. I believe somebody has to stand, somebody has to speak out, somebody has to challenge the wrongs if we are to move and create a better country for ourselves. Somebody has to stand up and say, this is wrong, things shouldn't go in this direction.
He says his name, Pilato, is an acronym for People in Lyrical Arena Taking Over. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
21 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Egyptian politician Mustafa Musa said today he would compete in presidential elections hours before a nomination deadline was set to make President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi the sole candidate after withdrawals and a boycott call. Several leading opposition figures called yesterday for a boycott of the March election, citing a wave of repression that has cleared the field of challengers to Sisi and left his top opponent in jail. Former military commander Sisi was elected in 2014, a year after leading the army to oust Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. He is expected to easily win the vote, the third since protests in 2011 unseated longtime ruler Hosni Mubarak. Arab media quoting family members is reporting that Saudi financier Prince Al-Walid bin Talal was released by the government Saturday after being detained at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in the capital Riyadh since early November. Terms of any eventual financial settlement between the prince and the Saudi government were not immediately known. Edward Iranian reports from Cairo.
Top Saudi financier Al-Walid bin Talal, whose kingdom holdings own shares in a number of large U.S. corporations, including Twitter and Citigroup, was released after several months of detention in Riyadh's luxurious Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Arab media reported that close to 90 other top Saudi businessmen and royal family members were also released following financial settlements with the government. The men had been detained since early November after the government launched a probe into alleged financial improprieties or corruption. Unconfirmed reports in Arab media suggest that the Saudi treasury may have raised up to several $100 million from financial settlements with the prominent figures it had detained. Prince Al-Walid, the most prominent of those detained, told Reuters in an interview shortly before he was released that he was innocent of any financial improprieties and that discussions with the government were taking place amicably.
There are no charges. There are just some discussions between the government, you know. I mean, but rest assured that this is a clean operation that we have, and we're just in discussion with the government on various matters. And that I cannot divulge right now because we are in confidential discussion with them. But rest assured, we are at the end of the whole story.
A top Saudi official, however, told Reuters that while he would not negate or confirm what the prince says, for sure there is no settlement unless there are violations, and they are not concluded without the accused admitting it in writing and promising not to repeat it. The official added that he had no doubt that Prince Al-Walid would continue to head the kingdom holding company. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that he doesn't think the main motive behind the arrest of Prince Al-Walid and other businessmen or figures from the royal family was financial. Kashan argues that many of the people detained did not endorse Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman when he became Crown Prince last June, and the latter wanted to impress on them that he will soon be in charge of the Saudi kingdom.
The more important dimension is political, and the aim of Mohammed bin Salman is to consolidate his powers ahead of replacing his father, which might happen anytime soon. Remember, his father is in a very frail health.
Kashan adds that he does not think that the money raised from the corruption probe will solve any of the kingdom's deep-seated financial problems, and he argues that one of the major drains on Riyadh's finances is the ongoing war in Yemen. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has taken a number of initiatives to restructure the Saudi economy, including the privatization of Aramco, the country's iconic national oil corporation. He has also cut off various financial subsidies to members of the royal family, provoking the ire of some of its members, while at the same time receiving kudos from members of the public. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And a small spaceflight startup has successfully sent a rocket into low Earth orbit for the first time from a base in New Zealand. Rocket Lab says it is the first company to send satellites into space from its own launch facility on New Zealand's North Island. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand has joined a small and exclusive club of spacefaring nations. Rocket Lab's launch in the Mahia Peninsula could allow smaller companies to launch satellites into space for far cheaper than its traditional rivals, at around $4.9 million per launch. The rocket used an engine designed and made in New Zealand. In what's believed to be a first, the engine used electric pumps to drive parts of the machinery. The joint US-New Zealand startup aims to disrupt the established space sector by launching its satellite-carrying rockets every week. They'd have a wide range of uses, from monitoring crops to providing internet service. The company hopes to begin commercial launches next year. Peter Beck is the founder and chief executive of Rocket Lab.
Think of Rocket Lab as a glorified freight company. What we're doing is we're taking spacecraft and placing them on orbit to provide services down on Earth. So people don't realise how much they rely on space infrastructure, things like GPS, satellite television, it's all coming from space. And these two particular satellites, they were weather satellites, providing weather services and Earth observation.
The New Zealand Space Agency says the successful launch would boost the country's presence in the international space industry. The government agency wants global companies to manufacture satellites and rockets in New Zealand. The Rocket Lab test flight also placed a highly reflective sphere in orbit. It looks like a large disco ball and should be visible to the naked eye as it crosses a twilight sky. The company says its Humanity Star is an attempt to create a shared experience for everyone on Earth. Eventually, it will fall to a height where it will burn up. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
I'm Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat. Join us this Tuesday as we discuss cholera and what is being done to contain the disease in Zambia. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.